I'm Rip Esselstyn, and you're listening to the Plan Strong Podcast. What's the single biggest way that we can reduce our impact on the Earth's resources? We're going to find out today with lifestyle medicine practitioner, registered dietitian, and longtime environmental activist, Dr. Peter Johnston, right after this message from Plant Strong. I want to tell you something, and that is operating a food company has been one of the most challenging endeavors of my life. From innovating products that we want to land at the intersection of taste and nutrition, to wrestling with supply chain issues and managing inventory, I have had more sleepless nights in the past 3 years than I have in the last 30, including the 12 when I was a firefighter. But no one tells you that food is hard. But I also want to say, it's because of each of you that we continue to get in the trenches day after day after day. It's in our core values to keep at it, knowing that we are filling a giant void in the market with products that you can't find anywhere else. And this makes it easier for us to climb out of bed each day. I want to thank you for your patience. We are anxiously awaiting the return of our organic pancake and waffle mixes, and we're excited to announce that our Plant Strong milks will be available online later this week, followed soon thereafter by the return of our exciting new burger mixes. Our goal is to be your reliable and trustworthy partner for all things Plant Strong, allowing you to stock up on healthy meals that you can make and enjoy in minutes while still managing your busy lives. I appreciate each and every one of you and want you to know that the effort will be worth it once more brands start to care about the integrity of the nutrition that they're putting into their products. Thank you so much for your support, and please stay tuned for exciting updates at PlanStrong.com. Several months ago, I received an email from my guest today, Dr. Peter Johnston. Peter's a native New Zealander that's now living and practicing in Australia, and he's a registered dietitian with a master's in nutrition and dietetics and a PhD in human genetics. He's also a fellow of the Australasian Society of Lifestyle Medicine. In his email to me, he shared a very powerful PowerPoint presentation about the impact of food systems and the environment, and invited me to use this information from his research any way that I saw fit. I can't think of a better way to celebrate Earth Day than by having Peter on the podcast this week to talk about his work and share solutions for our climate, soil, animals, and the health crisis that is afoot. Here's the thing. We can't feed the whole world today on a Western-style diet. We all are aware of this. There just isn't enough land or resources. And it's going to be even more impossible with the forecast of 10 billion people by mid-century, and Dr. Johnston proposes a solution for each of us and ways that we can cast a vote for the kind of world that we want. And yes, it can be as simple and powerful as avoiding meat and dairy products and eating more plants. Please welcome to the Plant Strong Podcast, Dr. Peter Johnston. All right, Peter Johnston, all the way from Australia. Welcome to the Plant Strong Podcast.
Thank you, Rip. It's a pleasure and honor to meet you. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. How are you doing, mate?
It's early in the morning, but I'm caffeinated, so I'm happy and well. It's 6 a.m. here, and still dark.
Hmm.
But midsummer.
Well, so what exactly is the time there? Here it's in Austin, Texas, it's 1:03 in the afternoon.
We're about 16 hours ahead of you, so I can tell you what's going to happen in the future.
That's pretty trick.
It's 6 a.m. Yeah, Wednesday morning.
Well, so Peter, you have a real passion for all things plants and trying to get the world, for the most part, to eradicate itself from animal agriculture, which you've done a lot of research on and proves to be very, very inefficient and costly to both our human health and to the planetary health. And I want to dive into that in great detail. But before we do, I'd love to learn a little bit more about you. So tell me, you're in Australia. Were you born and raised in Australia?
No, I'm a Kiwi. I'm from New Zealand.
Seriously? Wow.
Yeah, so I grew up in beautiful New Zealand, the land of the long white cloud, as it's called by the Maori, the native people there. Well, sometimes they called it the land of the wrong white crowd.
Okay.
I came to Australia in 87 to do my PhD here in human genetics.
Got it, in human genetics. Okay. And along that way, you've done a lot of other things. I mean, so what along your path led you to decide that you wanted to, you know, get a PhD, human genetics? And I think before we started rolling here, you mentioned that you also got a PhD in aging and somewhere in Montreal, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I did my PhD in Canberra here at the National University in human genetics to study aging. And that took me to Montreal to do a postdoc. But that didn't go very well for multiple reasons, the bully boss, lack of genetic engineering equipment. So I left academia and left that job and never came back. I did a range of other things, including about a decade as a pretty much full-time political activist, fighting for social justice causes in New Zealand, Australia, and the US, and then retrained as a dietitian. So I came back here and did a master's in nutrition and dietetics in the mid-90s.
What kind of social justice causes were you fighting for?
Environment, feminism, anti-uranium mining, racial justice, free education, anti-capitalist stuff, pretty much the whole kit and caboodle for more social justice. So that was a tremendous education. I had pretty much 7 years doing that full time, and we read and studied voraciously the whole time. So wow. World history, politics, economics, theory. You know, we produced our own newspaper and distributed that. So that was interesting, and it wasn't the smartest career move, but it was a hell of an education around how the world works and how power works.
I would imagine so. And it's probably one of the things that has forged you into who you are today.
It has. Yeah, I developed a really strong sense of social justice, and I was already a vegan then. But the others in the organizations with me weren't interested in that at all, despite me raising it. So that was a frustration. They didn't see it as important or relevant.
Isn't that something to me? It's kind of bewildering to me that we're working with a bunch of people that are really passionate about social justice, and yet they can't see something what to you and I, and I think all of our listeners see is so blatantly obvious, is the social injustices around our food system, our current food system, and what it is doing to humanity, the planet, all that stuff.
Of course, how it's speciesism, how, you know, I think there's a lot of violence involved in the way we produce and exploit animals. And I think we'd have a much more gentle, peaceable population if we didn't treat animals like that and we recognized them as fellow sentient beings. And also, they were environmentalists, but they were blind to the environmental destruction of animal agriculture. So very smart, good people, lots of amazing people I met in those years, but just the blinkered cognitive dissonance, maybe they like the meat. their eggs, their dairy, et cetera.
Yeah. No, I think cognitive dissonance is the perfect term for that. Mm. So you mentioned before we jumped on here that you did for several years, you were doing something with sheep. What exactly was it you did with sheep that we should know about?
You have to be careful how you phrase that in New Zealand. No. It used to be.
Like I think anywhere, not just New Zealand.
Right. New Zealand used to have about three times more sheep than it had people.
Oh.
They joked that it was a land where men were men and sheep were nervous.
Awesome, Peter.
Anyway, this is probably a family show, so I shouldn't go any further, but I worked in shearing gangs as a young man during my summer holiday. So
hold on for a sec. A shearing gang, what does that mean exactly?
All right, this doesn't translate. When New Zealand produced a lot of wool and sheep's meat, so the wool was a big valuable product. So the sheep needed to be shorn once a year, so spring and summer. And so they had specialized professional shearers with support staff who'd pick up the fleece and get the sheep out of the pens, and people like me, I did the pressing of the wool bales. So that it was a team of people. We had a team of seven usually with one cook, and we would travel around from farm to farm, work 7 days a week, 5 a.m. to 5 p.m. until the flock was shorn. And so long days, very physical work, very hot and sweaty in these hot sheds with just a tin roof, no insulation. And I did this for three summers, all summer. It was good pay for a young guy. But seven of us plus the cook would eat a sheep a day because it was such physical work.
And so when you say you'd eat a sheep a day, so you'd be, give me an example. From 5 a.m. to 5 p.m., how many sheep could you shear? Are we talking like 250 or are we talking 500 or are we talking 50?
Lambs were quicker because they're smaller, but from memory, the top shearers would shear about 400 sheep a day, and there'd be usually three shearers, three rouseabouts, who were the ones who swept away the droppings and picked up the fleece and brought it to the presser, which was me.
Okay. and then what? At some point in the day, would you guys kill one of the sheep to eat, or was there a cook and that was his job? How did that work?
We had a cook, and it was always a female, but just sign of the times, I guess. The farmer would have a sheep or two hanging in the shed for about a week, getting a bit more ripe so it was tender. And my job as the presser was to cut off the manky bits where there are flies at it and butcher that animal. It was already skinned and gutted. So I would have to cut it into pieces and bring it up for the cook. And then we'd have we'd start at 5. We'd have a cooked full meal, 7 a.m., midday, and after we'd showered at finish of day at 5, after 5 p.m. So that cooked meal would be huge amounts of sheep meat, potatoes, and vegetables.
And can you remember over the course of those three summers, did you get absolutely sick and tired of sheep meat or not?
Oh, no, it was such physical work, and I was, you know, that age, I was always hungry. So the boss even joked he was going to have to cut my pay because I ate so much. So it was really physical work.
And you were probably, 6 feet, 130?
No, I've always been skinny, but I was around 6 foot then, yeah.
Okay.
It was really hard work. So you were really hungry when the food came out, and we had two cooked morning tea and afternoon tea, each, you know, scones, biscuits, cakes. We had an enormous amount of food.
And so did that experience, did that affect your move to go and become plant-based?
No, not a bit, actually. It wasn't until I met a vegetarian girlfriend at university, when was that, about 1980, 81? And she was the first person I'd ever met who didn't eat meat or fish. And I thought it was pretty weird. But she was really nice, and we lived together for 3 years. And pretty quickly I picked up the habit and decided I couldn't eat meat anymore. I literally gagged on a ham roll at university and said, I'm done. I'm not eating meat or fish again. And I had knew nothing about the environment, nothing about health, nothing about ethics. I just didn't like it anymore. And I began to learn after that about the impacts. But we'd arranged to not eat meat at home to make it easier when we were living together, and we were living with my sister and her boyfriend. Four of us, you know, share accommodation. It was cheap for students. So, and I was still having meat outside of the house. But once I gagged on this ham roll, that was the end. That was 81. I became vegetarian.
81, and then you went fully plant-based in 91. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, after reading John Robbins' seminal work, Diet for a New America.
Oh, yeah.
In Montreal.
You were good for you for being curious and reading John's book. That book really swayed a lot of people.
To go
plant-based.
Yeah, there's a whole generation of John Robbins vegans around the world. I've met one at my yoga studio here. We're good friends now. She became vegan around the same time. Same reason.
Wow. Fantastic. So I'd love to know a little bit about, you've got a whole bunch of degrees. Will you share with everybody the degrees that you have before I start peppering you with questions on food and the environment and all kinds of good stuff?
Well, I don't want to sound like I'm boasting. I was more.
Yeah.
I was trying to avoid getting a real job. And in those days, you got paid to go to university. So it was it was easier to stay on and study. But I started with a bachelor's in psychology because I didn't know what to do. I'd worked a little bit after school and having the failed attempt at being a trainee teacher, I didn't like that. So I did a psych degree with politics and philosophy. But towards the end of it, I realized – for some reason, I got obsessed about not aging and terrified of dying. So finished that degree and right off the back of that went straight into a science degree with as much genetics and biochemistry as I could get. And so I did a BSc honors degree in zoology, which is where all the genetics and physiology and biochem was in those days.
Yeah.
And then got a scholarship to Australia, came here in 87 and did my doctorate, a PhD in human genetics. So we were cloning and sequencing and splicing DNA. And that was really giving me the tools and the skills to pursue research into causes of aging. Because I was obsessed with not getting old or not having my parents die on me. Mm-hmm. And I wanted them to be able to keep living. So I was in a race against time, as I saw it, to find out what causes aging. And I was pretty convinced then and now that it's programmed. So I did that. I finished that degree.
Let me interrupt you for a second. And so you came to the realization that it's programmed, meaning what? That we can maybe extend the our lifespan and our health span, but we're all going to die.
Extend the lifespan and health span, but whether we died or not, the idea was that it would only be by a tragic accident that you could live indefinitely. Mm-hmm. But then, I began to realize that this would be a crazy thing. It wouldn't be very socially sustainable, and the rich would probably benefit first. And I began to be a little bit more socially conscious of what this would mean, but my postdoc in Montreal didn't go well. I had a bully boss and they didn't have much recombinant DNA equipment. And I saw senior academics losing their jobs because their funding didn't go through. Yeah. And they had mortgages and kids. And I got disillusioned with academia. So I ski bummed for a year in Banff, Canada.
Beautiful place.
Oh, heaven. Heaven.
Lake Louise, Banff, Nordic, good places.
Yeah, some of the happiest days of memories of my life. But then I drifted down to San Francisco where I had a cousin and got accidentally into political activism. That really opened my eyes. So after a period there, I came back to Australia and did a master's in nutrition and dietetics. I decided I needed a new career.
Right. And so, and that's kind of what your career is today, right?
Yeah. I'm a dietitian. I've worked in health promotion, community development and local government for quite a while. But since COVID began, I've been full-time private practice and running retreats, lifestyle medicine retreats with a couple of colleagues, which are amazing fun. I know you do them.
Yeah.
And they're intense and a lot of work, but they're really gratifying.
So gratifying.
And they're so life-changing to see people's changes within 7 days. And we've done workplace health programs as well, which is also amazing to do. And those are a lot less hands-on, but you can get enormous changes as well.
Yeah. It seems to me, I've known several New Zealanders over my life, and it seems that every one of them has this wanderlust to get out of New Zealand and travel the world. So is that basically what you did with Canada and Banff and San Francisco, or did you do more than just that?
And haven't you noticed they're all good looking and intelligent?
It's a crazy. Truly.
Yeah, it is. I think growing up there, it's paradise and it's stunningly beautiful, but it feels like the end of the earth and like you're missing out on the bigger world.
Yeah.
Because it really is tucked away, sort of out of the way, and it's a long way to anywhere. I mean, it's a 3-hour hop over to Australia, but it's still pretty isolated. So Kiwis have this really strong compulsion to get out and see the world.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of travelers, and there's about a million of them like me who didn't come back. Like, actually, we're going back to New Zealand tomorrow for a month for a holiday. So, because I haven't been back since COVID.
Wow. Are your parents still alive?
My father passed away in 91, sadly, of a brain hemorrhage at 71. My mother's still alive, but she's in Australia now. She lives nearby, and she's turning 88 this year and is doing great.
Right. Do you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, sisters in Melbourne, brothers in London. So all of us have fled New Zealand. I've got lots of cousins and friends in New Zealand who I'll be checking up on and visiting and hang out with when we go back.
Got it. In reviewing and looking at your bio, I love seeing that you're a avid yoga practitioner. How often do you practice yoga?
3 times a week. If I can, and yoga one day, gym the next. So I pump weights, even though it doesn't show, but I think I'm destined to be tall and weedy, but I love yoga. I've done yoga for decades. I started at uni in Christchurch, probably in New Zealand in the early 80s. And I've had some gaps, but I've done it solidly for 10 years now, 3 days a week at least.
Right.
And I love that I'm 65 and I can still do handstands.
Wow. You're 65. That's incredible.
Yeah. And we have like workshops the other weekend. We did an hour and a half of handstands and drills. And I'm the oldest in the class by decades.
So can you walk on your hands?
Not yet. I'm working on it.
Okay. All right. We'll work on that together. I can, but not for more than, 8 seconds.
Well, you were a professional athlete.
Oh, well, I mean, but walking on your hands is a completely different animal.
It is, I know.
And then you also, are you still competing in speed windsurfing?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Wow. That is intense.
It's crazy. Yeah, you're going out in gale force winds in the rare places where you can get flat water and high wind. So that usually means behind a sandbar. Or it's, a freakishly flat lake in South Australia that stays flat even when it's windy. And so we're doing like 80 kilometers an hour, which I think is 50 miles per hour.
Oh, yeah.
On these tiny little boards like an ironing board and fully powered up. It's an equal mixture of fear and adrenaline and excitement.
And then you're doing a water start, you're getting harnessed in, and then you're just taking off.
Yeah.
Gosh, incredible. How long have you been doing that sport?
Since 79, I bought my first board in New Zealand. I had a long gap when I was traveling and poor and as a student. But I did a lot for 6 years or so after I started. Then I've been back into it heavily for 20 years.
Well, that's kind of a sport that our family, the Esselstyn family, my brothers and my sister and my parents, we got into for maybe a good 3-4 years, and that's what we would do for vacations. We'd go to different places and we'd windsurf.
It's expensive though, and you've got to lug a lot of gear around, and you need different sails and different boards for different winds, and it's not a user-friendly sport. Young people are switching to kite surfing or foiling, wing sailing.
Yeah. All right, great. So let's get into the weeds here. Okay, I want to get serious with you, because you know you've got some pretty big aspirations here for us as a society. And first, you say that we are in big trouble. We are in big trouble. You want to talk about that and what you kind of mean by that?
Yeah, well, we're an ecological overshoot, and I'm very indebted to the work of Professor Bill Rees from Canada, who developed the concept of the ecological footprint. But we're overusing all the key world's resources, and we're, our society is utterly dependent in every aspect on fossil fuels, which are a finite resource. They're a one-off carbon pulse. Once they're gone, they're gone. And we're not building renewables yet with renewables. We're still using fossil fuel to build solar panels and wind towers and et cetera. It's estimated that every calorie of food we eat takes 10 to 20 calories of fossil fuel to produce, to get it to you. So that's the growing, the transporting, the refrigeration, et cetera. It's wildly unsustainable. All the biodiversity is collapsing through taking their land for, you know, vast agricultural farms. We're seeing a collapse of insect populations. We're losing topsoil. We're pumping out groundwater faster than it's replacing. There's just multiple pressure points on our ecosystems globally. We're overfishing the oceans. Climate change is just one aspect of multiple problems. It's a symptom of overshoot.
Yeah.
It's definitely a big problem, but there's a whole host of other problems that are bearing down upon us.
Yeah, you refer to it as a multiple interrelated diabolical crises.
Yes.
Kind of all hitting us at once.
Yeah. And each one of them would be an enormous challenge to address. And yet there's probably 15 or 16 different of these diabolical crises facing us.
Yeah, at least. Let me ask you this. What is the health of Australia like? Does it closely mimic the health of America? Or I should say not health, but the sickness, as far as the obesity, the diabetes, and all that stuff.
Yes, we're very close behind. We're not quite as bad as the US. I was traveling to the US frequently before COVID for conferences, et cetera. Where I've met your mother and father, by the way.
Oh,
delightful
great
people. Yeah, and done workshops with them. Australia's not far behind. We've got 70%+ are overweight or obese. Most working age adults have multiple risk factors for chronic disease. Self-reported in the last census, around half of Australians report having one or more chronic diseases. Many of them will be pre-diabetic and not realize what risk they're in. Many will have significant vascular damage and be, you know, ticking time bombs for heart attacks or cancer. So we're an incredibly sick society.
Yeah. Is it my understanding is that Australia is becoming pretty pro-vegan, plant-based. Is that your sentiment as well? Are you seeing that?
Yeah, it's growing very fast, very fast. And every time there's a new documentary, we get a wave of more people embracing it, checking it out. People are much more open to it. Every family has a vegan with one of the kids or grandkids or cousin or brother. Like the new series on Netflix, You Are What You Eat, has led to a wave of people wanting to join our Whole Food Plant-Based Aussies Facebook group.
Oh, great.
So a lot, like hundreds.
Yeah. I saw a graph, I think it was on Plant-Based News Instagram channel yesterday, and it showed that I think just last year in the UK, 1 million more people now identify as vegan, which now is now well over, I think it's 3 million people in the UK. And I don't know what the population is of the UK off the top of my head, but what's Australia? Are you guys at about 25 million?
I think it's 26 now.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's been growing fast. Like we've been taking in 500,000 immigrants a year since COVID. There's creating a little bit of infrastructure pressure, housing shortages. So there's some pushback, but yeah, it's a big country, but unlike the US, most of it's not fertile or livable.
Right. Let's get back to talking about some of these diabolical crises that are kind of all going on right here at the same time. You talk about biodiversity loss. And one of the things that I found interesting in reviewing your presentation on this is that 10,000 years ago, we had basically 99% of wild mammals existed on the planet, and humans accounted for just 1%, right? And that's flip-flopped, right, since then. And you say that this is basically going to lead us, you know, we are in the sixth mass extinction. What does that mean exactly? We are in the sixth mass extinction.
Well, there have been previous mass extinctions for different reasons, like dramatic climate change, asteroids, large volcanic explosions, eruptions. This one is anthropogenic, meaning it's caused by humans. And we are competitively displacing wild species through taking over the land, through vast monoculture, through use of pesticides and other poisons and sprays, clear harvesting the oceans with, you know, dragnets, overfishing, clearing all the trees, the forests are being cut back and reduced massively. So there's just loss of habitat. And apex predators are being killed wherever there are farmers who don't want them to take their animals. You know, so the wolves and the lions, et cetera, are taken out, they're killed. It's just a collapse of species on multiple levels.
Yeah.
And of that, the insects are collapsing about 8 times faster than vertebrates. But the ripple effect of that is the lizards and the birds and the creatures that eat the insects are also facing food shortages, and they'll face population declines and collapses potentially.
Well, you mentioned how we could have a world without insects within a century, and explain exactly why that is such a travesty. What does that mean for humanity and life on Earth?
Well, the first thing most people would think of is we need pollinators. About 70% of our food supply relies on pollinators, which are insects, bees, etc. And if they go, then we will have enormous trouble feeding ourselves. We will anyway, for other reasons that we can discuss, but pesticide use is now considered the main cause of insect population decline. We're also eliminating the habitat that they live and breed in, like shrubs and trees that were more prevalent in forests, but also climate change is causing stress and decline in species. I've seen data in North America about the massive decline in monarch butterflies.
Yeah.
We have a parallel here with these things called bogong moths. Now, 30 years ago when I was in Canberra doing my PhD, I remember in season you'd see clouds of these moths floating around, like thousands, millions and millions and millions of them. And if you were driving, your windscreen would be covered in bugs. Any time of year, there'd be enough bugs that you'd have to stop and clean your screen and your headlights at dusk, you know, at a petrol station every hour or two. Now that doesn't happen. The bogong moths are massively declined, and there's a lot of species that rely on those creatures for their food.
Yeah. I just find it to be, it makes my stomach sink, right? Thinking about that and how the diversity of the you know, all the insects, all the animals, all living things. And when you remove, you know, in one fell swath, one part of it, you're taking the legs out from, you know, an important part of what makes us tick.
As a, great.
Yeah. What about deforestation? You know, we know deforestation is absolutely running rampant in the Amazon. Do you have deforestation in Australia?
Enormous, sadly. Yeah. And it's clearing scrublands with trees for more cattle grazing mainly. A lot of land clearing still happening, especially in the north. The state I live in, they've only just stopped native forest logging. It's stopping in the next year or two. And this is old growth forests that are, you know, hundreds of years old and complex, amazing ecosystems. It's unthinkable that they still consider it okay to log that stuff when we have a lot of plantation timber available. You know, this is there's a lot of political lobbying that's enabled this to continue, but it's really criminal what they're doing. But you mentioned the Amazon, like the tropical forest tree loss is still enormous, and I'm so glad there's been a change of government in Brazil. But the Amazon apparently is now a net carbon emitter rather than net carbon sequesterer, and it's reaching a tipping point where it could burn completely, like we had rainforests in Australia burn in the large bushfires of 2019-2020 over that horrendous summer.
Oh yeah.
When much of Australia was on fire, and those rainforests have never burnt in any known history. You know, they're not supposed to burn. They're rainforests. They're supposed to be too moist. So the Amazon is drying out gradually as it's getting its margins nibbled at, and the planet's heating. The Amazon's so big it has its own weather, but this is going to change. It will burn and it will turn into savanna probably unless we do some dramatic changes and start to protect it.
Yeah.
And in many ways, it's the lungs of the planet. You know, these forests really are so vital for biodiversity and the ecosystem and the climate.
Yeah. Well, it's like Dr. Seuss's The Lorax. It's like, how can we not see what we're doing to ourselves and to this precious planet that we live on? And how do we continue to allow this egregious behavior? It's mind numbing to me.
Yeah. It's like the tragedy of the commons. You know, each individual person or business is pursuing their own interests without looking at the bigger picture. And I think we have, my partner's a trauma therapist and she deals with sociopaths and psychopaths and narcissists. And they, from what I know, these people tend to rise to positions of power or end up in prison. And so, you know, corporate leaders, military leaders often can be sociopathic, which means they have no guilt or shame and they're ruthless. And I think these people often rise to positions of power where they pursue their own interests and greed without regard for other people or other creatures or the environment. I think it takes a certain personality to recklessly endanger our home in this way. I think there's also an ignorance. It's easy to feel like the earth is vast and resilient and it can take whatever we, you know, throw at it with a chainsaw or axe or fire, but there's too many of us. It's not able to withstand the multiple assaults on its ecosystems globally, and we're seeing the result of that. We've passed six of the nine planetary boundaries. You know, we're overtaxing the Earth in almost every aspect.
You said something that I don't know if I've ever heard before. We've overpassed six of the nine planetary boundaries. What are those boundaries?
Actually, I can't recite them all, but there's like the amount of I don't have this in my slide set because I don't usually refer to that, but it's a concept that it's key. The scientists worked out there are key areas that we have a finite amount of Earth's resources we can use, and there are 9 of those areas, and we've overreached 6 of those 9.
Right. Well, and in your presentation, you know, you mentioned how, you know, we're going to be approaching 10 billion people on the planet here within the next, you know, couple decades. That in and of itself, I would imagine, is going to be surpassing one of those boundaries.
Yes, correct. And so many of the experts who look at this closely are the ecological economists, estimate that perhaps the carrying capacity of us humans is maybe 1 to 2 billion for the planet to live harmoniously with the Earth's ecosystems. And we're at 8 billion now as of late last year, predicted to go to 10 billion before we plateau. Now the footprint of those people, especially as they move towards a high consumption Western lifestyle, is just going to be way more than the planet can sustain. We're already overreaching the planet's resources every year. So the footprint on the planet, it's already, we live like we have 1.7 planets. You know, so we're digging down into the resources faster than they can renew.
Yeah. When you said we're going to, you know, reach 10 billion and then plateau, do you know why is it that we plateau at 10 billion?
Birth rates are declining globally, especially in the more developed, wealthy countries. In fact, they're below replacement rate. The lowest, I think, is South Korea, which is about 1.1 babies per couple. But all the developed Western countries and China are populating at below the replacement rate. There's big population growth in the very poor countries, like particularly Africa, and that's traditionally been an economic and education and a matter of availability of birth control, fertility control, etc. But those countries are also predicted to plateau in future as the women get more control over their own fertility contraception, etc.
Well, that all sounds very as far as doing the right thing for Mother Earth, because we're so overpopulated, that sounds like a smart solution, right? Have less children, or don't have any children, be child free and adopt.
Absolutely. I mean, in some ways our own stupidity is helping us, because the fertility rate of humans is also dropping steadily at several percent per year. And this is environmental pollutants, poor health. Right. So couples around the world are having more trouble having babies because they're just not healthy and they've got too many environmental contaminants, pollutants. It's not quite clear what the problem is, but we're not able to produce enough babies in many countries. So that's actually a good thing in my mind. It's sad for the couples who want a child, but
absolutely. What about you mentioned in your presentation the collapse of fisheries. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, there are multiple factors happening there. We're essentially overfishing, where most of the world's fisheries are in collapse through overfishing. And experts will argue that where any fishing is overfishing at the moment, the oceans are in such dire state. Yeah. And anyone who's seen that amazing documentary, Seaspiracy, will get a deep dive into this. I'd highly recommend that. We waste a lot of fish. Up to a third of fish is wasted before reaching the plate. A lot of fish are dumped, or they're fed to fish farms, which is like a food factory in reverse. You know, so you give 10 kilos of fish meal to get 1 kilo of farmed salmon, for example. But fish growth is being slowed by increasing ocean temperatures and plastic chemical pollution like BPA.
Yeah.
We're also decimating populations of seabirds, of whales and dolphins, of turtles, seals. We're clear fishing sharks, you know, so through the whole ocean food chain, we're stressing it and overtaxing it.
We need to
stop fishing.
We are successfully doing everything in our power to not live in harmony with the other creatures that we inhabit this planet. It's sinful. It's despicable. And hearing you talk, it just makes me disgusted with us as a race.
Me too, and it's heartbreaking. And I don't think they're all bad people involved in these industries. I just think they don't know what they don't know. And many of them are poor people who need to make a living and feed their children. It's just that people are not taught about what we're doing and provided with alternatives. Like, for most people around the world, they still have to do a job they don't really like, get up every morning and bring home money for their mortgage or their rent and their kids. And many times that will be a job which is environmentally destructive, but if people don't have the education and the opportunity, they don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's the leaders at the top who know this and are not doing anything that I really have anger for. I mean, anger is not really a healthy emotion, but they're the ones driving this. It's the captains of industry who are educated enough to have a sense of what we're doing. But as I said, many of them will be sociopathic. You know, they'll have children and grandchildren, and they won't be even factoring that in.
Could you let the audience know about the inefficiency of animal agriculture? You have some stats in your deck that I think are pretty darn powerful, and I can jog your memory if you
sure.
want. Yeah.
No, I know this stuff from.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'm delivering this talk so often. The best estimate was from an amazing study from Oxford University in England in 2018 by academics Poor and Nemesik, and they surveyed over 90% of the world's food production from a bottom up. Data collection point where they got food data from almost all of the world.
Yeah.
And what they found was that animal agriculture is using 83% of all the world's farmland, but it produces only 18% of our calories and about a third of our protein. That is wildly inefficient. What that means is if we stopped farming animals and we let animals go wild again and didn't have feral animals. You know, cows and sheep don't belong in Australia. Chickens are not from Australia. They shouldn't be here at all.
Right.
They're terrible for the soil and the ecosystems. So if we stopped animal agriculture, we could put 76% of all the world's farmland back to wilderness. How powerful would that be? That's amazing. We have the solution at our fingertips, which would take our foot off the throat of this precious planet within a year or two. If these animals would die out, or we'd feed the remaining livestock to those who wanted their last bit of animal-based meat, and this would be an enormous reprieve for the planet.
Enormous, enormous, and so absolutely necessary.
Well, yeah. And we won't make 1.5 degrees or let alone 2 unless we change animal ag, unless we get rid of it. We have to change the way we produce food, because it's such a big contributor to global warming, amongst other things.
Yeah. So can you just very, very quickly mention it, but I think it probably went over a lot of people's heads. You mentioned 1.5 to 2 degrees. Why? Can you explain the importance of those numbers?
Well, they're considered to be points we shouldn't go past. It's dangerous to get warmer than 1.5 or 2 degrees. And most of the time... Sorry, Celsius, yeah. Yes. Most of the scientists I know are listening to and reading are saying it's too late for 1.5 degrees, but we'll race past 2 degrees Celsius warming if we don't change how we produce food. We must change the food system in order to have any hope of not having runaway warming and reaching dangerous tipping points like losing all the world's polar ice, melting the methane permafrost regions, which release enormous amounts of methane, multiple tipping points. The ocean currents could stop or change direction.
Right.
The oceans will get too warm. You know, there's multiple scary potential tipping points that we might pass if we don't keep temperatures beneath these agreed limits.
And yeah.
The scientists say there's no hope of doing that without massively reducing animal ag.
Yeah. Talk to me for a sec about antibiotic resistance and why that is. What exactly that is and why that it's important that we get that in check.
Yeah, this one particularly terrifies me. We're squandering our precious antibiotics globally by overusing them in animal ag. So they're administered prophylactically to factory farmed animals in particular. So it's estimated that about 80% of the world's antibiotic use is for farming for animals. Now what this means is that because the concentration of those farmed animals in feedlot farming especially, so this is cattle in the US and more around the world, pigs and chickens particularly are farmed intensively in these intensive feedlots. So those are stressed animals, they get more sick. So they give them antibiotics prophylactically to keep them well, but it also coincidentally makes them grow faster. So there's an economic driver to this. But what it means is the bacteria are being given more of a chance to develop resistance against those antibiotics. And so one by one, those antibiotics are becoming useless because if they're administered to someone with an infection, they don't work anymore. We're more and more seeing people get infected with antibiotic-resistant bacteria. We're approaching a pre-antibiotic era again. What that means is if you get a bad infection in your leg,
yeah,
amputation is the only option. It means that hip replacements are off the table. Cesarean births are off the table. These will be too risky. You cannot do these without antibiotics. Mm. So for most people, if they get a bad infection, it'll be removal of that area of the body, that limb, et cetera, or they die.
So, yeah. So according to the research that you've seen, how long do you think we're potentially are going to be in that era?
Well, it depends on how fast we can find new antibiotics and also stop wasting them through overexposing them to bacteria in factory farming. Mm-hmm. So the bacteria mutate and adapt very quickly because they have 50 life cycles in a day mostly. And so they can change genetically. They can learn to live with these antibiotics. So we're in a race against time. And it seems like there are not the incentives globally to produce enough new antibiotics. And they're very hard to find and develop.
Mm.
And so if we squander the ones we have, our current arsenal that keep us safe and allow these operations and allow us not to have amputations through infection, then we're in deep trouble.
Yeah.
You know, so deep trouble.
Talk to me about food security and about how, you know, you talk about how the soil that we have, it took 500 years to develop this healthy topsoil. And we're effectively, of course, we're blowing that as well.
Yes. Well, industrial farming is leading to a net loss of topsoil every growing season because we're not farming regeneratively. We're not farming organically. We're clearing vast areas of land and the dust will blow away. The topsoil will run away in streams and rivers. And so, like many of the world's resources, we're depleting the topsoil faster than it can regenerate. And it can take 500 years to develop another centimeter of topsoil.
Yeah.
And the thin layer of soil around the globe is what keeps us alive. Otherwise, we're living on a rock and we can't grow food. And grass won't grow. It becomes desert and infertile and not viable for producing any food. So we need to shift how we do agriculture so that we build the soil with every growing season. This means regenerative organic agriculture, where the soil is alive and full of microbiome, and the vast, you know, populations of microbes that live in the soil and keep us healthy, keep the plants healthy. Modern industrial agriculture is spraying poisons on the soil continuously, and it's not really correctly, no, shouldn't be called soil. It's more just dirt, and we keep those plants alive with petrochemical fertilizers and sprays. So we need to rethink the way we do agriculture. And places like the Rodale Institute in the US are doing amazing work. But permaculture is also incredible. That was developed out of Australia. Mm. And we practice permaculture in our section here in Melbourne. My partner is trained in it, did an intensive 12-month course. So this is the way forward. We need to think about farming sustainably in a way that regenerates the soil. And the nice bonus is that will sequester carbon from the atmosphere.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you've got a higher level of organic matter in the soil.
What's the actual cost right now for us eating animals? You say how we pay for cheap animal food three times. What are those three times?
Well, we pay at the cash register when we pick up a slab of dead animal. We also pay in subsidies to animal agriculture industries. And thirdly, we pay in the externalities that animal agriculture creates with health and environmental costs and damage.
So, you know, Peter, all this is pretty darn dark. And frankly, a wee bit, or I should say a huge bit, depressing. So what can I do? Like, what can every one of the listeners to the Plant Strong podcast, what can they do starting tomorrow to help basically mitigate and do each and every one of us do our part to try and turn this thing around?
It's a great question. And I agree, this is quite depressing. You can start this before tomorrow. You can start with your next meal, your next snack, by not eating animal food. Pack up the animal food in your house and give it to someone you don't like.
Okay.
Because it will harm their health. But don't eat it and don't buy any more. If you eat plants, that's the single biggest thing most people can do, unless you're a very frequent flyer.
Yeah.
It's enormous, the contribution of not eating animal food. It vastly helps the world's environment. So that's it. It's exciting that we have the power in our own hands and our knife and fork. Every yeah. single one of us, to make an enormous difference to the future of this beautiful planet and the species that we share it with, who are on their last legs, many of them. So that's the really exciting thing. I would also say learn to grow your own food, especially if you live in a city, because cities cannot feed themselves. They rely on a river of trucks every night. And it's said that we're around 9 meals away from anarchy.
What does that mean exactly? What does that mean to you?
9 meals is 3 days. If we run out of food for 3 days, people get hungry, they'll start to riot. They'll start to knock on their neighbors' doors and ask or steal food.
Right.
People don't like to be hungry. If they're hungry too much, they'll move like locusts and look for food. And many people will do what it takes to get food. It will lead to conflict and war. So learning to grow food is important. So join a local gardening group, a permaculture group. Learn to swap food with your neighbors. Make friends with your neighbors. Your neighbor might have a good crop of potatoes and you might have a good crop of tomatoes and you can swap.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you call them tomatoes, but anyway. So there's a lot you can do in that regard. And knowing your neighbors means you trust each other. So you're more likely to share and collaborate when times are hard, rather than be looking to sneak over the fence and steal their food from the garden.
Yeah, yeah. What about, what do you have any, you mentioned earlier in our conversation about being supportive of, I think, regenerative agriculture and
absolutely.
Organic. So you're a fan of organic and regenerative, right?
A huge fan. Organic is probably better for our health from what the science shows. But the strongest reason I recommend organic is because it's better for the environment. As I said, the pesticides are killing the soil. They're the leading cause of insect population collapse. We need those insects. The earth will do fine without humans, but we won't last long without insects.
Yeah.
And so organic is a better choice. If you know the farmer, you're with a local community-supported agriculture, and you're supporting that farmer by providing them with income, and you know that they're farming regeneratively, then you're voting with your dollars to support agriculture that's helping the planet rather than harming the planet.
What about reducing food waste? How do you recommend we start that? Because I know that food waste is out of control.
It's terrible. We waste over a third of all the food grown, and a lot of it's at the household level. Yeah. I was talking to a patient this week saying, I buy lots of fruit, but then I notice it's rotting and I have to throw it out.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, we're about to go away tomorrow. We've got about 10 ripe bananas because we have a smoothie every day for dessert. So we'll skin and freeze them.
Yeah.
And they'll be good to go when we get home in a month. And so you can cook the fruit up when it's ripe. You know, you can keep an eye on it to make sure it doesn't go off. You can buy what you need, and you can plan times where you cook food before it gets too old.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole lot of ways to reduce waste.
And what about what are you going to do with those 10 banana peels that you've turned into frozen bananas for your smoothies? Are those banana peels going to go into an organic compost bin?
Of course. We have four huge organic compost bins in our garden here. I don't know if you can see outside.
That's the great. I love seeing that, Peter. Way to be.
Trees. Yeah.
Walking the walk, my man. I love it.
Most people don't realize you can actually eat banana skins if you wash them. They're quite edible. There are recipes out there for cakes made with the whole banana. You clip the top and tail off and take the little sticker off, blend it up, and you can put that in the cake. So I think if times get hard, we won't be composting them. We'll be eating them.
Well, you know, Carly Bodrug of Plant U, she actually turns banana peels into banana bacon.
Yes, I've heard that. Compost it.
Yeah. I was talking to my brother the other day, and he was telling me that I can't remember what war it was. It might have been the Civil War, but these men in the wintertime got so hungry and they were so low on food, they were eating their leather belts.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine that. What you have an acronym called LETS. What exactly does that stand for?
It's a local exchange trading system. So this is like a green dollar local economy. So it means that you might have a skill, like you can alter clothing, or you can cut hair, or you can mine someone's pet. And I was in one of these when we lived further north years ago, and they were fabulous. So what it means is that you trade your skills and no money changes hands. So you get an agreed credit for, say, an hour of trimming, fixing clothing, you know, patching up socks or adjusting trousers. And in that return for that credit, you can then purchase something like a haircut or someone gives you a lift. And so it's not taxed, and governments don't usually tax this, but it means you've got a local sustaining economy where you're supporting each other with the different skill sets you have. This is a beautiful way to build community and have a more sustainable and sharing economy where there's less waste.
Yeah. So speaking of less waste, are you a big fan of people downsizing and less is more?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have to live more simply. I'm a huge fan of a guy, Nate Hagans, who's one of your compatriots. He's in Minnesota, I think. He's got a really good podcast. I love his work, but he says we need to live much more simply. Because everything in our worlds is dependent on fossil fuel to dig up, to grow, to transport, to manufacture, to deliver, we're not going to have that luxury. We're going to have to get used to less energy driving our society, and that means building things to last, fixing them, repairing them, sharing them, not consuming as much, learning to live with less and more simply, yeah. And using our neighborhood and our community to support each other.
Yeah. And in return, to me, by downsizing, by getting rid of all of the trappings, societal trappings and things that we think we need, you actually, a light bulb goes on, and to me, you become happier instead of searching for something, this elusive thing that you just can't ever catch on to, thinking that, if I could just have this, and I could have this, and I could have this.
Yeah. The capitalist economy encourages that continuous consumerism, because that's what drives the economy.
Yeah.
And if we're not growing, then it's considered a bad thing. It's said, I don't know if you've heard the saying, but we in the modern world, we're encouraged to spend money we don't have, to buy things we don't need, to impress people we don't like.
Oh, my goodness. Great. Can you say that one more time, if you can remember it?
We're encouraged to spend money we don't have.
Yeah.
To buy things we don't need, to impress people we don't like. And that's the state of the modern world. It's very sad.
Yeah, truly.
And we end up with cluttered houses. And when it's hard rubbish day, every year you see households with all this crap on the front lawn for the council to pick up, things that have built-in obsolescence that don't last long, that break after 6 months, and they end up in the rubbish and go to landfill. Mm-hmm. And it's this mindless consumerism. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, we had woolen socks that were handmade, and we've repaired them when the toe went out.
Right.
We fixed trousers. You know, we repaired clothing because it was expensive then. It wasn't made with cheap or slave labor in third world countries. Mm-hmm. It was made in New Zealand locally, and it cost a fair bit. So we looked after those things, and we repaired them and made them last. And when you outgrew them, they were handed down to your younger sibling. This doesn't happen today.
No, not to the extent that it should. Not even close. What's the Darwin app? I think you're a fan of the Darwin app.
Yeah, I heard this guy on a podcast that one of my friends runs, and he's actually the grandson of Charles Darwin, the theory of evolution. He lives in Australia now, and he's passionate about us eating less animal food and the environment, and he created this app that you can get for free on your phone. So if you look for Darwin Challenge, and it calculates the environmental impact of every animal food-free meal you have in terms of how much longer you'll live, how many cars it will take off the road, how many fish, chickens it will save, how many people it will take out of chronic malnutrition, how much water it saves, how much land it saves, how much forest it saves. It's brilliant. They did a lot of research to make this accurate,
yeah,
to make sure that the calculations are there. So this can be really motivating for people to look at and see how much change they're leading to with their food choices.
Mm. I'd love for you to finish up by talking about some industry initiatives that are going on right now that that are hopeful and give you hope.
Yeah, I like this aspect. This is not food that I will be buying because it's replica animal food. You know, this is happening already with things like Beyond Beef and Impossible Burgers. I've never had them and I don't plan to because I don't like meat. I don't want a meat replica that looks and tastes like meat. And these are not really health foods.
Are you calling that a replica or replicant?
Oh, it doesn't matter. They're fake. Okay. You know, they're meant to appeal to meat eaters, and they're the key audience. I think the business people who are making these are smart. They know vegans are not their key market. But if this is exciting because organizations like RethinkX, which is San Francisco-based think tank, for example, they're forecasting that the rise of these alternatives that don't require the animal, that can be produced in a lab or a factory, is so fast, and there's so many billions of dollars going into this globally, that by the end of this decade, it will essentially make animal agriculture obsolete.
Yeah.
And if not stranded assets, these will be cheaper, they'll be better, they'll be safer, you won't get food poisoning from them, They won't have salmonella or listeria or campylobacter like so many of the animal products. There won't be people dying from poor quality mincemeat. So the people who love animal foods can still eat them and they won't know the difference, and it will be better and cheaper and safer. And so this is going to put the animal ag out of business. They're not viable. They'll be stranded assets and so bankrupt. So the farmers will need to be supported. We need government programs to help those people transition, to train them, hopefully to rewild that farmland.
Yeah.
To help new species come in, plants and animals, and to help give the earth a massive breather. But these things excite me, even though I'll never buy them, because they're going to put animal ag out of business, whether we all turn vegan or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to your point, I mean, as much as we all want the human race to be healthy, I think the most important thing right now is we need Mother Earth to be healthy so that we can thrive. And without Mother Earth, we're all going down. We're all spiraling down the drain.
Correct. Yeah, there's no healthy people on a dead planet.
No. You know, Peter, you've got a really, really great energy. I love your mission. I love the way you have, you know, traveled down your path in life and where it's led you and what you're doing now and all the great work and the people that you're helping. And, you know, when you reached out to me not too long ago, I immediately was thinking this is a guy that I really want to come on the podcast and to share your passion for a better and a healthier civilization and planet. And, you didn't disappoint. You were fantastic. Really appreciate you.
Thank you, Rip. And I do have an enormous passion to help people have their best life. Yeah. So it's a joy to help people get healthy. But my main driver now is for the environment.
Yeah.
That's every person I can get to eat more plant food and less animal food or no animal food is a victory for the planet.
Yeah. Well, you are so eloquent, so well-spoken, and love your accent. Love could listen to it all day long. Really could. So what do you got planned for the rest of the day since it's now, you know, 7 a.m. Australian time?
In half an hour, I've got a mentee. So I mentor new dietitian graduates. I'm doing that for an hour via Zoom.
Yeah.
He's in Queensland. Then I've got a patient or two. I've got to finish my packing for New Zealand and sort out a few things. We haven't had a holiday for a while, so we're excited to be going back to my home country and touring around, catching up with old friends and cousins and having some beach time.
Good. You got a place to stay while you're there?
Yeah. We're renting a car and we're just cruising around. And I do feel guilty about the fossil fuel and the traveling, but we live incredibly lightly during the year. We've both been plant-based for over 30 years. We grow lots of our food. We regenerate our soil. We don't drive much.
Yeah.
We've got solar panels on our roof, solar hot water, solar electricity. You know, we do as much as we can. So,
yeah, good for you. I think that you deserve the trip back to your homeland and a little vacation time. Yeah. We'll take in some of the fresh air and the ocean breeze for all of us that can't be there.
Thanks, Rip. And it was a delight to meet with you. Thank you. I've enjoyed your channel for a long time.
Good. Well, thank you, Peter. And it was great having you on. Can you hit me with a virtual Plant Strong fist bump on the way out? Boom. Go get him, Peter.
Thank you.
All right. Over and out, mate.
Take care.
Dr. Johnston has given me permission to share his slide presentation in our show notes with all of you so that you have the facts and the science behind this environmental crisis that we face. As Maya Angelou has said,
When you know better, you do better. It's my hope that after listening to this podcast, you know a little bit more and are empowered to make changes that have big consequences. Thanks so much for listening. And as always, let's keep you and Mother Earth Plant Strong. I'll see you next week. The Plant Strong podcast team includes Carrie Barrett, Lori Kordowich, and Amy Mackey. If you like what you hear, do us a favor and share the show with your friends and loved ones. You can always leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, make sure to hit that follow button so that you never miss an episode. As always, this and every episode is dedicated to my parents, Dr. Caldwell B. Esselstyn Jr. and Anne Cryle Esselstyn. Thanks so much for listening.